so thank you for all coming and for the introduction. And I've been asked to speak for about 40 minutes, so I'll do that. And then there should be a chance for questions at the end if you have any. And it's not something I've ever published about this, but it's something I've been thinking about for a while, which is the way that the Edo period shogunate, obviously you are not all Japanese experts, but Japan has this figure called we call him today the emperor. It's not a very good translation, but this figure had been ruling effectively for most of history, but never had power. And power was almost always in the hands of the shogun, who ruled on behalf of the emperor notionally. Each emperor had to nominate the shogun, but they never had the choice. The shoguns said, nominate us, and they had to do it. But anyway, that's the way that sort of history unfolded. But in the period that I look at, the early modern period, it's Japan's third dynasty of shoguns, begins in 1603 and continues until 1868. And in 1868, there is a kind of convulsion, a little civil war, and Japan decides to reconfigure itself as a Western-style country, modeling itself on various other states that were emerging around in the 1860s as modern-day countries. And today, if you think of a modern-day country, there's things that come to mind about what you must have to be considered a developed country. But in 1860s, if you wanted to be considered a developed country, one of the things you absolutely had to have was a monarchy. And that sounds old-fashioned to us today, but Germany and Italy, Thailand, even Britain, they're all totally reinventing and reconstructing their monarchies in the mid-19th century to look modern. Holland as well. The only exception really is the USA. So Japan sees this and starts to reinvent a monarchy. They could perfectly easily have said, let's make the shoguns our kings. But for various internal reasons, it's very complicated, we won't go into today, the shoguns were marginalized, and this long-standing but fundamentally submerged family were brought up to become modern-day kings, and it was very unexpected and quite difficult to make that transformation. And much has been written on that, not least because that transformation happened in 1868, so this is the 150th anniversary this year. So partly it was me thinking about the so-called opening of Japan in 1868, the transformations that is being discussed a lot in Japan right now, and my own area of research, which is the preceding shogunal period, maybe think about, in our historical terms, I am not a historian, what happened. And we hear a lot about the creation of modern art schools, there was an introduction of education system, introduction of conscription into the army, all these things happened. But in terms of the way that the state presented itself, what happened? So I begin here with a very bland and quite, it's not a great work of art or anything, but if you had been wandering around Japan before the opening of the country under the shoguns, how would the governing regime have appeared to you? Right? And if you know, you're probably from very different ethnic and cultural and national backgrounds, but if you wander around London, it's obvious, right? Now, wherever you go, it says E2R, right? The Queen's monogram is on everything. Post offices, you know, the flag flies. You have the Queen's head on your coins and on stamps. Royal this and royal that. You go to Trafalgar Square and there's all the stuff. You know, if you come from a Western city, it's obvious that they're all like that. London's not any different from Paris or Rome. But it would not have been like that in Japan. First of all, monarchies are very hidden across East Asia. That, of course, you know you have a ruler, you pay taxes, and there are things you've got to do. But you never see them. Right? There is no visible kingship at all. And the shoguns began as military figures. They led troops into battle. They fought on behalf of the emperor. They killed his adversaries, and they put down uprisings, and they were a very dynamic presence. But, of course, if they do their job successfully, then there aren't any uprisings, and there aren't any wars, and so the shoguns, too, leave the battlefield, disappear into mansions, and the fundamental building that you would have seen every time you pass an important structure was the gate. We don't have that. Now, Western architecture doesn't have gates. You know, if you're a nice, grand country house, it might have a lodge where a servant lives to open the door so the Lord can drive his car or his horse in. But Western architecture is not based around the concept of the gate, but Japanese was. This happens to be a temple, a royal shogunal temple. There's not very many secular buildings left because everything was destroyed in the Second World War or before. But this is what you would have seen. So you have an enormous architectural gate, which of course is alerting you to the fact that behind it is a really important building. But you can't see it. The point of the gate is to be bigger than the building that's behind it. And this, of course, is a picture, so it's not like a genuine photograph of the gate. But as this artist, who's, you probably all know about Hokusai, Hokuju is his less famous pupil, so this is a 19th century image, Hokusai has made the picture deliberately so that you cannot see anything behind. All you know is that it's a grand, important government building, a royal space, and therefore you, as commoner going past on the street, or buying a popular tourist print, which is what this is, you better not see it. And it's been added here. Can you see right in the middle, bang in the middle of the picture, we have a person here bending down slightly with two swords. Okay, it's a bit hard to see, but he's got two little sticks hanging out the back, right? So he's a samurai. Samurai wear two swords. And groveling in front of him is a person with no swords who is therefore a merchant. So this picture very goes out of its way to show proper social interaction. Right? A commoner on his knees in front of a government representative is exactly the way the regime wanted itself to be displayed. So this is a very proper and very correct picture in terms of how the shogunate would have wished itself to be presented. It ends up being, perhaps you might say, slightly boring as a work of art, even though it's supposed to be a tourist picture of this important temple. The artist doesn't feel able to actually show us the temple, right? It's hidden. And we get this in many areas, particularly the royal family themselves, but the shogunal family. You would expect, if you're coming from a Western standpoint, that you would know the shogun's name. No, we all know the queen's name. We all know the name of the president of the United States. We all know what they look like. So here I'm showing you the first shogun died in 1617, so the picture's a little bit later than that. Died in 1617, but nobody knew his name. Nobody knew what he looked like. Right. He had actually been a real general because under his rule there had been genuine fighting. He had led troops into battle and things. And at that time probably people did know what he looked like. But as peace comes, he disappears into the cloisters. He is just simply not known. And this portrait, there's something very funny with your PowerPoint because all the images coming out squashed. It doesn't look like this. It's much too narrow. This is the same, right? Everything is turned into a square. It doesn't matter. I mean, I'm not the kind of a historian that's too obsessed about that, but it doesn't matter. The point is, it's a rather small picture. And any picture showing such an important person has to be a private image for the family. Right? But it was inconceivable that you would make an image like this for outward general display. Right? And indeed, the first shogun, his name is Tokugawa Ieyasu. On death, he's given a posthumous name. Right? And again, think of the British situation. Foreigners call her Queen Elizabeth. No British person ever calls her Queen Elizabeth. She is the Queen. Right? She doesn't have a name. We know she has one, but we don't use it. But when she dies, there'll be somebody else of the king, so you need to have to refer to her. At that point, you know, like we say Queen Victoria, when she was alive, she was the queen. Now she is Queen Victoria. So similarly, in the case of the shogun, when he dies, people are going to start to need to refer to him. History books will mention him, so he's given a posthumous name. Right? So Ieyasu is the name, you know, his wife would have called him that, but today we just say it openly, but they would not have known it. He is just simply the shogun, and at death, though, he'll be given a posthumous name by which he can be referred to through history. But in his particular case, the first shogun was so significant because he had brought Japan out of civil wars and had established this third shogunal regime, that he was deified. It's Shinto, right? You've heard of Shinto. It's polytheistic. There's a 30,000, they say there's 30,000 gods, so adding another one doesn't make a lot of difference, but hardly any Shinto gods were ever human beings, right? They're all, you know, mythical figures from the past, so they never were human beings. So he was a human being, became a god, and then having made him a god, the regime says, like, oh, oops, like, now he's a god, people are going to want to worship him. Right? But we don't want people to worship him, because we don't want people to see pictures of him, we don't want people to even conceptualize him. So what they do is they say that he is an avatar, right? Modern day people know the word avatar from computer games. He is an avatar of a Buddha. Right? This is strange, right? He's a Shinto god, nothing to do with Buddhas. But in order for people to worship him, they say, let's make him a Buddha, because Buddhas are open. Anyone can see a Buddha, look at a Buddha image, worship a Buddha. All the commoners do that. But so that he's created as, you know, this great, great man. We want people to venerate him. They turn him into a Shinto god, but then they backtrack and say he can be venerated only via an understanding of his conceptualization as a Buddha. And there are many, many Buddhas, but one Buddha was associated with the easterly direction, and he's called the Medicine Buddha. And because the shoguns lived in the east, Kyoto is in the center, right? And that's where the emperor lives. Shoguns govern outside in the east, so he's associated with the Buddha of medicine. And you can see that because he's got a little medicine jar in his hand. So if you needed to venerate the shogun, if you needed to honor him, and you might sometimes need to do that, you do it via the Medicine Buddha. It's unproblematic. It allows him, his name, his appearance, everything to be hidden. And as he was made into a god, and that god is declared to be an avatar of the Buddha, there is a great shrine built in which to honor him. Right? And the shrine is built in a place called, oh, I haven't written it down there, sorry, and I've also mistaken it, sorry, I should say pleasure. I just typed it wrongly. This is a much later book which has an illustration, this has nothing to do with it, illustration of this temple built to the first deified shogun in his guise as Shinto god and Buddha. And at the top, it's still there, it's a very grand religious precinct. Many people would have walked past because it was it was in the countryside, but on a major route. And this picture artist called Shiva Korkan has made a picture of it. And the picture obviously was published, it's in a printed book. That's why it's black and white, margin down the middle, because it's a printed book. Having been printed, some authority, we don't really know, it must have been probably a government censor, has said to the author or to the publisher, that is the mausoleum of the shogun. How dare you make a picture of it? You can maybe make a picture of the gate, hiding it, but this is showing the buildings there. And so the book is banned, right? The book is banned, and the picture has to be reissued with a different picture, right? There's the original one. And the new issue, same part of the cactuses, doesn't matter, but this thing has been replaced, sorry, it's a bit out of focus, replaced by a picture dashed in for a second edition. This is the actual traveller, Shiba Korkan, showing himself walking to see the shrine. So it's there, human beings might see it with their eyes, but don't make pictures of it. Silence and hide. And this we see across many, many arts. The first shogun is especially important, but the third shogun also living in the 17th century, quite early on in the period, a huge pair of beautiful gold screens, which is the most formal kind of art in Japan. You have paired gold screens that you paint on. A pair of gold screens was made to celebrate that shogun's magisterial achievements, right? And this is what it looks like. This is one of the pair. Sorry, you can hardly see anything. But this is the castle, Edo Castle. This is the bay with ships in it. And all kinds of grand things he did and buildings he put up are shown wonderfully across the screens. And obviously, if you're making screens of the shogun's life and achievements, he's going to figure in them, right? He appears about 8 times doing things, right? And if it's a screen like this, it's a very grand and expensive object. Probably it was owned by a very important government minister. We don't know who owned it, but someone very important. But of course, once the painting's made, it's going to be installed somewhere, people are going to see it. People are going to look at it, and they're going to say, oh, where's the shogun? Let's find him in the pictures, right? It's interesting to see. You never know. It might even be a servant, you know, a cleaner, somebody who's just done the toilets, walked past and has a look at the shogun. Totally impossible. So he's painted eight times, and each time he's painted hidden, right? They show him, and they hide him. So this is just bad images. This is the shogun viewing a hunt. There he is in a chair with an umbrella, positioned so we cannot see him. Here he is riding out to view military exercises, and he's got a hat on, so you can't see him. All right. So what's particularly interesting about this hiding? There's many regimes in which you can't see the king, right? I mean, for example, the Mughal emperor can't be seen. But in the Japanese case, it's more interesting than that. If you don't see him, it's like pretending he doesn't exist, and that's rude. So you go out of your way to show him not being seen. Right? They could easily have not put the shogun in the picture, but you put him in, and then you show him being hidden. You do an enormous temple building, you put a gate in front of it, you know something's there. They could have not put a gate, just have trees and hedges and nobody will ever know. But you must know that your vision is prohibited. Right? It's a very clever kind of binarism. Don't ignore him, but don't see him either. Another instance, this is the last one I'll show, and then come to talk about a few other things. This is that same place we just saw, the shogun's mausoleum up the top of the hill. This is made in the Edo period by an artist who is aware that he better show respect, i.e. by all means make pictures of it, but make sure your picture also hides it. So we have here a dignified clerical person, a very senior clerical robes. Only the highest abbots wear red, so we know this is a very important, dignified abbot who clearly is on his way up to the top, right? It's a long climb, right? He's down here somewhere. He's about to climb up to do his venerations at the top, and everything, can't just about see it there, but it's hidden by trees. Right? We see it, and we don't see it. Another example here, this is a guidebook. There's plenty of guidebooks made to the city. They call it Edo. We call it Tokyo, the shogun's capital. Lots of people come up the countryside to view the city, or servants come, you know, and they want to go back home to the countryside with a book commemorating, you know, showing the villagers what the city looks like, and anything it's to do with commoner activities, you can have a nice, clear picture of it. That's absolutely fine. But anything to do with government activities, you can't depict it. But you mustn't omit it from the book, because that's insolent, like it's pretending it doesn't exist. So all these books begin, first place, the shogun's castle. And you see it not being seen, right? So behind all this, this is description and telling you about it. Here is the castle, right? Little bit of a kind of here, can you see a little bit of a tower here? Another one here, but fundamentally, we can't see it. And then there's the moat, huge stone moat it had around the outside. We just see a bit of a wall, enough to tell us. And then, for added good measure, the artist has given us here a crane. Cranes are very auspicious. They're said to live for 1,000 years. So when you draw a crane circling around something, it means this will endure. Right? Oh, shogun, please live forever, it's saying. And down the base, terrapins, right? Freshwater turtles, which were said to live for 10,000 years. So they, whether they really were, you know, of course, crane can't be guaranteed to really be flying around. We put in the picture a way of showing the prestige and authority, and then also Mount Fuji, you know, it really was there, you can see it, but often Mount Fuji is covered with clouds, right? Mount Fuji is a very frustrating mountain because you can hardly ever see it. It's almost always hidden by clouds. And if suddenly it appears on very, like today, fresh blue sky, suddenly, oh my God, you can see Mount Fuji. Everyone dashes to have a look. It still happens today. Wonderful view, right? normally you can't see it. And so Fuji also indicates this kind of reticence of authority, because Mount Fuji is not just a lovely mountain. It is the icon of Japan. So, properly speaking, it should not be too easy to scrutinize. Sometimes it'll appear, mostly it won't. Well, that's sort of a constant. I mean, this is the way that regimes showed themselves or didn't show themselves across all of Japanese history. So if I'd been saying this lecture to a Japanese person in the year 1750, or a Korean person, or a Chinese, they'll say, you know, yeah, we all already knew that, right? Same way as if I stood in front of you and told you the Queen of England puts her name on things. We'd say, yeah, we know that. That's what all monarchies in the West do. It's obvious. But what becomes a little bit intriguing is this historical Japanese understanding comes into contact with a foreign system, because Japan, you know, like the West, intrudes into this historical mode. Japan, of course, have had contact with the West before. Certainly they'd also learnt about the West via books that come in from China. Their ships sometimes come in from all over the place. The Dutch send ships to Japan. Japan, by the way, is the world's best producer of copper. Was. That's why people go to Japan. Nobody ever goes to Japan for any other reason except to get copper. There's nothing else produced that it wants. But Japanese copper is so good, it was actually worth sailing all the way from Holland just to get it, even though ships go down. And also, you know, the second biggest producer of copper in the world is Sweden, which is next door to Holland. And still it was worth going all the way over to Japan to get copper. So Japan is this big source. Europeans really, really want to go to get copper. And when they get there, so they encountered this, you know, and they see these things. But it's like Hong Kong. The Europeans are trading very far away from the center of things. They don't care very much. The Japanese don't care about the Europeans. Do a little bit of trade. But suddenly, in the period of international empires, the West intrudes in Japan in a much more forceful way and says, you know, like, we want you to become part of our Western trading system. We want you to, ideally, we'd like to colonize you. You know, we're colonizing everywhere else. And so Japan realizes that they will have to take the West on its own terms. They're going to have to start presenting themselves in the rubric, in the guise of a Western country, or else they will be declared, you know, old-fashioned, oriental, unable to reform themselves at exactly the moment that the Japanese are reconfiguring themselves. The Burmese monarchy is thinking about the same thing, and the Burmese monarchy come to the conclusion that they'd rather stick with their old historical ways of behaving, and guess what happens? The British depose them. Right? So the Japanese, basically the options are, probably no one will actually colonize Japan, because why bother? It doesn't have anything you want, except a bit of copper, and it's also too far. The Japanese are very warlike people. So colonizing Japan is not really an option. But treating it as an oriental, primitive kind of place, like the Europeans treat Thailand or India, right? The Japanese don't want to be perceived that way. So they begin a process of transformation, looking at the West in its kind of own terms. And they move away from this culture of royal concealment. Now, this is one of the only surviving gates. I just showed you a picture of a temple gate, because temple gates on the whole, you know, they still survive today because people don't burn down temples, but all the government buildings, of course, you know, the next regime comes along and destroys them all. So this is really the only one that we have left. This kind of very, very severe iconography of visual prohibition. And here I'm just showing you a page of a guidebook which a commoner could have looked at to see what kind of lord has what kind of gait. So you know going in front of it, is this like in European terms, is this person just a sir somebody, or is it a duke, or is he a government minister, or is he just a rich man? And you can be sure you better know when you go past, because it shows you how deferentially you should pass in front of it. But everything is hidden. They move from that to an outward-going visual dispensation. This is one of the very first images which in which a Japanese artist tries to understand and conceptualize how a Western city might look. Now, this artist had never been to the West, and they didn't really have a clue. So what they've done is pieced together a whole lot of images that don't... No Western city ever looked like this, but they've, you know, some pictures have filtered in, and they've tried to imagine, and it's a kind of bricolage of an imagined Western city, and the artist, Aldor Denzen, and he does this picture in the 1840s, so before the West is coming into Japan very strongly, but it's beginning to appear, and he calls it a city square in Germany. There's nowhere in Germany. If anything, it's Rome, and this looks like to me, I think this is the Louvre, isn't it? It's been banged in there, and this is the, you know, Trajan's Column, whatever, but we see that they're thinking Western monarchies depict themselves in the public zone. They make monuments of their achievements. Their palaces are built with huge wide facades, right? Just as European architecture never really conceptualized the iconography of a gate, Japanese buildings never conceptualized the facade, right? What is a facade? A facade is a way that you show to the public, you know, look how amazingly great we are. Oftentimes, Western facades are fakes, right? Go around the back and the building doesn't look so good around the back, but all the, you know, beautiful stonework and pillars and like Buckingham Palace, right? Go around the back and most of it's actually made of brick, but in the front, putting out all the things in the shop window, you're supposed to see how amazing it is. And this picture's also included something else, which is there's a big carriage here, right? Hasn't told you who this person is. The artist has no idea. But it's a windowed carriage, right? The idea that important people go around in vehicles with glass windows. Japanese important people travel around, obviously, they have to go places. Always, they're in totally enclosed boxes. You can never see them. There's a little vent so they can breathe, and there probably is their family crest on the outside so you know how important they are, but no visualization of rule. The first Japanese persons who go to the West see this kind of thing and come back, because Aldor Denzen is making it up, boring things that you see in Western pictures. There is the first time that a Japanese person goes abroad, sees a lot of what happens in the West, and comes back to tell the story. People have sometimes, you know, been shipwrecked, gone abroad, but they never returned to tell what they'd seen. The first one is a man that comes back just in the 19th century, so it's a little earlier even. And he was shipwrecked, his ship lands in Kamchatka, right, in Siberia. Probably he's going to die of cold there. But by amazing lucky chance, there happened to be an expedition from St. Petersburg University, a bunch of botanists who were investigating the flora and fauna of this remote area, and they come across him, four or five Japanese survived, and they take them back to St. Petersburg, right? And those Japanese, of course, you know, they're extremely rare and interesting to the Russians, and so they do all kinds of things a Japanese person never could normally do. They go to the opera, they're taken all around the streets, and they meet Catherine the Great, right, the Empress of Russia. And the Japanese are kind of like terrified, right? I mean, in Japan, if you get anywhere near the shogun, you collapse with terror and fear, right? These Japanese, they kind of, you know, they're properly briefed or whatever, and they get in, and they not only have this experience, but they are given a picture of the Empress to take back. And when they get back to Japan, that picture of the Empress is copied into a book all about their Russian experiences. And you can imagine the Japanese elite really want to read about this, but they ban the book, right? Because they don't want people to know what other countries are like. They don't like the idea of comparative political economics. So the book is written, and this often happens in Japan. What they do is they allow the book to be written, and it's allowed to circulate in manuscript. Many, many, many books in Japan are allowed to circulate in manuscript. It means the government is suspicious of the content, but they're not going to ban it because actually it's okay if some people read it, but it can't be published. Once it's published, it's cheap, right? To have a manuscript copy, it's a long book. Manuscript copy is going to cost you quite a lot. So it really means only kind of rich, important person's ever going to get to see it. So this book, it's called The Tales of a Northern Voyage, right? That's the name of the title of this expedition. Katsuriga Hoshu is a government minister who writes down what he's told by the returning and a person, and he copies in all the pictures. But what's really interesting, he's not only shown the picture of Catherine the Great, he's shown it all curled up at the top. Can you see? It's curled up at the top. He's telling you, this is a cheap print. It's not a grand portrait that the Queen has, you know, in her palace. Any old common person has pictures of her. Totally breathtaking to the Japanese elite. And when this man comes back, he knows all this stuff. They don't know what to do with him, right? He hasn't committed a crime. They can't kill him. So he's locked away for the rest of his life. He lives for another 25 years. He doesn't live in prison because it's unfair to prison him. He's locked away in the Shogun's garden. It's a nice place, actually. He wanders around all day with the plants. I mean, he's kind of free. It's a sort of house arrest. But he can never tell anyone what he's seen. So these things are happening. That's 1806. This is round about 1840. People are moving towards an understanding of what the West is doing. And then the Americans turn up. And the Americans say, you know, we are going... Sorry, I'm going to jump all this for lack of time. Stick on that one for a while. The Americans turn up, and this is the other thing, by the way, he saw in St. Petersburg. I don't know if you've been to St. Petersburg. The center of St. Petersburg has this enormous statue of the founder of the Russian Romanov dynasty, right? Peter the Great. So, not the founder. Founder's Tsar Michael, isn't it? But the one who moves the capital of St. Petersburg from Moscow. And it's one of the great statues of the Baroque age. And what was especially noteworthy about this statue was it's on a life-seeming plinth, right? Trafalgar Square, everything. They're on the top of a pillar. But this makes you really feel, I'm meeting Peter the Great. It's a bronze statue. It's not, you know, the colours of life, but it's supposed to make his presence real. And this is something the Japanese regime can't deal with. But anyway, in the 1860s, not dealing with this anymore, pretending it doesn't happen, is not an option because the gunships are sailing in, first from America, then from Russia, then from Britain, and saying, you know, you've got two options, basically. Either you accept this, become a Western style, think of yourself, conceptualize yourself Western, or else we're just going to burn you down. You know? So Japan has this rapid transformation, and they achieve it quite successfully in the way the Burmese monarchy does not achieve it and gets destroyed. The making of royal icons is something that the Japanese regime is suddenly going to have to do. You can make portraits of the king, and they start to do that. The Meiji Emperor, the first emperor that comes into power as a Western-style monarch, 1868, the so-called Meiji Emperor, because he's not called Emperor Meiji, that's a mistake. He still doesn't have a name. Even to this day, the Japanese emperor has no name, right? I mean, his wife calls him something, but we don't know his name. Today, you can find it on the internet, and it's not illegal to know it anymore. But in the old days, totally nobody must know. But how do you refer to him? So he's given an era. The era in which he lives will be called this. And therefore, he's called the emperor of that era, right? So the 1868 to when he died in 1911 is called the Meiji era. So he's called the Meiji emperor, but he's not the Emperor Meiji. It's not his name. Anyway, it doesn't matter. An icon of a painting of him is made, and Western advisors say, oh, well, you know, every town in England, every town hall in England and every university has a picture of Queen Victoria in it, so you better have these things circulated. And so paintings are made of the emperor and sent to the Japanese modern style town halls and universities, and what do people do? They put a curtain in front of them. Nobody dares look at it. Nobody would feel happy sitting in a room in which the emperor's portrait is there. Don't do it, right? I'm interested to know what happened in Thailand, because surely would have been the same in Thailand, but today, wherever you go in Thailand, the king's portrait's there. At some moment, Thailand made a very successful transformation whereby people want and feel the urge to see the king's face. But still to this day in Japan, no Japanese person, they don't want a portrait, you don't have to ban it, nobody wants a portrait of the emperor. Right? Today it's changed a little bit with Hello magazine type things, and you know, but on the whole, people don't care, don't want to know. But you can make the emperor's portrait, but they say, well, if you really want to do it, you've got to have a royal statue somewhere. And ever since the Roman Empire, royal statues should be on horseback. Right? And think of Trafalgar Square, right in front of Trafalgar Square, Charles I on horseback. Right? And if you've been to the Royal Academy, the exhibition of going on right now of Charles I, not just paintings of him, he's always shown on horseback. Otherwise, they're not a proper, real Western-style ruler. And that even goes through with generals from the past. I just took this yesterday, Trafalgar Square, with a nasty, cloudy sky. You know, all these people, they're always on a horse. But no Japanese emperor ever rode a horse. They just sat in their palace all day. Right? So the requirement, principle iconography of kingship, couldn't be done. In fact, they get around this by there's only really one or two loyalist generals who had fought on behalf, because most Japanese people fought for the shogun, because the shogun is the one who fights the emperor. Nobody fought for the emperor. It's not a thing you would ever do, right? But a couple of times in history, there have been people who, for various specific reasons, had fought for the emperor. And one of them is made into an equestrian statue. Sorry, I didn't bring you a picture of it. And to this day, it's right there in front of the imperial palace. Because they can't show an emperor, but they can show the next best thing. Right. I deliberately took this with a picture of a bird pooing on the top. Because, you know, another problem is that every time you do statues of people, birds poo on them. And this is something that the regime was also concerned about. Right? If you make a statue, not only it's too obvious for everyone to see, but also you don't know how, you know, forces of nature will start working on it. So anyway, the transformation that is required of the Japanese regime brings into conflict with deep-seated historical assumptions about the way monarchy should be. On the one hand, they want to be a modern-style Western monarchy because that's the way to, you know, sit at the table of great kings of the world, and the Emperor of Japan can get invited to Buckingham Palace and to the White House, and he won't be invited otherwise. But on the other hand, you know, you can't just change the way people think instantaneously. But one thing that happens, and this is the talk title, the gateway and the railing. The railing comes in, and the railing is a kind of icon of kingship that is very, very prevalent in the West, and the Japanese were sort of able to latch onto it. And what I mean by the railing is that it's a way of letting you see in, right? The point about a railing is that you can look in, but you can't go in, right? So, you know, just think of everywhere you go, right? Railings. It is the principal iconography of Western kingship, but at the same time, it's also, everyone ignores it, right? Nobody even thinks about it. You look through it, and you see this grand building behind. But if that railing wasn't there, of course, everyone could just walk in, and that's not permitted. But if the railing was a wall or a fence, or in the Japanese style, a gate, then you couldn't see it, and that would take away the whole point. So, railings. The very, very first railing ever put up in Japan, it's still there. It is in front, really interestingly, they made it for the zoo. The first zoo. Another thing that I've not got time to talk about today, but the equation of kingship with the management of rare and dangerous animals. So the oldest zoo in the world, I think I'm right in saying, is in Tower of London. Right? Not there anymore, but Tower of London, of course, was a royal palace until recent times. So the English management of royal animals, which are expensive, of course, and dangerous, and lions and things, they are icons of kingship in many cultures. But of course, they're very dangerous. But what you want to see, you can't see them. What's the point? So railings go back, much associated with the management of wild animals. And interestingly enough, first ones were put there for the commissioned in England and sent over from Manchester, where they'd been made, for the Royal Zoo. But actually, they are not installed in the Royal Zoo. I don't know why. They're installed in the mint, right? Coin-making place. So that's where they are today. Japan's mint is not in Tokyo, but in Osaka. And it has here this 16-leaf chrysanthemum, which is the mark of Japanese royal family. They've been using it for hundreds of years, but it is brought out and used sort of in place of coats of arms, which Western kings used. And this thing here, I don't know if you can see very clearly, it's those of you who know Chinese character, it's the letter great, which is part of the word Osaka. The O of Osaka means great. So it's an O with the word great. It's a kind of, somebody's invented it as a rebus for the city of Osaka with the royal. So here we have the first ever railings in Japan. Not as big as Buckingham Palace, but it's begun. So then I started thinking to myself, and I'll stop talking in a few minutes because you've probably heard enough of me, but the history of railings, you know, how do railings function as monarchical symbols? It's obvious that they let you see in, but they stop you from going in, but is it more to it than that? And then I thought, well, it's about wild animals. They're also protecting you. That kingship is terrifying. You know, today, hopefully, you know, we love the queen and everything, but for much of history, kings are very frightening. I mean, they can kill you and they can tell you to go and fight for them, and they, you know, they create wars. They demand your taxes. So that keeping them behind there, not only it stops us from going in, but it stops them from coming out. There's actually a double negotiation. A gateway very clearly has a front and a back. They don't look the same from both sides, but railings actually are identical from either side. The queen looking out sees exactly the same thing as we see looking in. What is the front and what is the back? Is it protecting us from her or her from us? So I haven't finished this yet, but it's a project I'm investigating. If any of you have any details, please let me know. Where does the railing begin from? Who put up the first railings? They are related to a bronze working, so technologically speaking, they could have been made at quite distant times in history, but the Roman Empire never had them. So, I mean, I've been told, you know, how would I know, but experts, they never had them. We don't find them in medieval castles. The first railings which are sort of important, and maybe there were, you know, somebody had done it before, are to be found in Naples. Maybe you've been there. And they are the cathedral. It's now the Cathedral of Naples. Wasn't originally the cathedral. Cathedral of Naples, where here they are. This is the main altar, and they are to the right-hand side of it. They guard a sanctuary. And today, if you're churchgoers, then, you know, when you go up to take communion or the Mass, usually there is a railing, right? That's where you stop and kneel down and receive the Mass. It's a way of telling you are on the threshold of something really, really important. Of course you can see beyond, and you're not going to go beyond it anyway, because what Christian wants to go up and desecrate the altar? You stay behind. Just telling you, this is the threshold. And these really important, and maybe the first ever railing, I mean, I think they're dated something like 1500 approximately. You know, maybe they're earlier ones, but this is really big time. They guard not only a sanctuary, but they guard the chapel of San Januarius. It's the word January, right? It is the saint of the gateway, right? January is the first month. It's the transition from one year to the next. And although it's brought into Christianity, a lot of Christian saints, you know, they weren't originally Christian saints. They've been brought in from other religions. And Janus, right, is the old god of thresholds. Roman god of thresholds. And the Roman iconography of Janus is two-faced. He looks both ways, back to the old year and forward to the new year. So this is incorporated into Christianity as the god of the saint of the threshold, and celebrated in January, the month of January, and celebrated here in the first railings. Right? And what is actually there? Why is this chapel so really important? It has in it the blood of Christ. Right? Now, of course, the Christians, any relic associated with Christ will be really important. Right? Islam, I'm not sure about Judaism, but certainly Islam and Christianity are really big on relics. Right? Some holy person's bone or hair or, you know, a bead from their rosary. Christians and especially Shia Muslims go to venerate these things. Right? So any relic of Christ, like a relic of Muhammad, right? This is why the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem is so really, really important, right? It has hairs from Muhammad's beard. Muhammad ascended into heaven. He didn't die on earth. Therefore, there's hardly anything left of his body. And, of course, Jesus Christ also ascended to heaven. There's nothing left of his body. Except, do you know which bit's left? He was circumcised, right? So Jesus' foreskin still exists. It's the only bit that was cut off before he died. So and there's three of them, supposedly. Three places claim to have the foreskin of Jesus. But the other thing is that, of course, he bled on the cross. And the story says that a woman, right? I forget her name now. Anyway, sorry, I can't remember. But anyway, a pious woman collected Christ's blood in a cup, right? And when he's dead, he ascends to heaven. Nothing of his body left on earth, but the blood was still there. And, of course, nobody would believe it today, but pious myth is that it was treasured over the centuries and eventually ended up in the cathedral of Naples. And once a year, right, that blood liquefies again, right? And they say it still happens. The current pope claims that it liquefied when he went to Naples, right? And, you know, God knows. Literally, God knows. But it would be brought out and shown here behind this. And that is the ultimate threshold, right? You as the believer encountering Christ. The division between liquid and solid. That's the fundamental division of all earth, right? When God created the world, what did he do? He divided the sea from the land. Right? That's the beginning of all things, right? The division of the sea from the land and the division of liquids and solids. And here, that liquid is passed back, cast back momentarily into question through the miracle of the there's a word for it, I can't remember, the liquefaction of Christ's blood with a railing. So that's a very long extension of a few thoughts I'm having about the significance of the railing, but it gets taken out of the church and brought into spaces of royalty and then circulates, and it seems to be accepted in a way that the king's portrait or the king sitting on a horse is too Euro-specific for many Asian cultures to be able to deal with. So we don't have the king of Thailand sitting on a horse either, even though modern-day Thai people do have the king of Siam, as they'd have called him then. We don't actually have Barack Obama sitting on a horse. We'd laugh at that. It's too much. It's too time-specific. It's too Roman, right? But the railings have just carried right on there, and they're still there, and we still have them, and we still want them, and we don't have a problem with them, right? They are so effective a symbol, they've almost become invisible to us, right? And it's exactly 6:30, so I'll call that the end of my talk, all right? So I'll be very happy to hear any thoughts you have on the subject, and cultures and times and spaces that I know nothing about, which might have some comparative interest. I'll be very happy to hear. Okay.